Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
There's a new buzzword in the Brussels bubble. Competitiveness. It's the reason EU leaders came to town this week. The Schuman roundabout was echoing with corporate speak. Lots of talk about changing the paradigm of the European economy in order to, and I'm quoting here from some actual discussion points, secure the union's economic resilience, industrial renewal, and technological leadership. But like any good buzzword, competitiveness is a gentle way to get at some uncomfortable realities. It's a classier way, for example, of talking about money. We need a lot more of it than we've got to pay for defense and the green transition. And competitiveness is also a more dignified way of acknowledging Europe's inferiority complex. European industries fear they're falling behind the US and China. So what does all this competitiveness talk actually mean in practice? And what do elections coming up in June and November have to do with this new obsession? I'm Sarah Wheaton, host of EU Confidential. First, I'm joined by Barbara Moons to give us the recap of the EU Leaders Summit. We'll also hear highlights from my colleague Giovanna Faggionato's interview with Enrico Letta, the former Italian Prime Minister. He's written a nearly 150-page report on how to overhaul the EU's single market to make it more, yep, competitive. Fix it fast, he told Giovanna, as well as EU leaders, or forget about being competitive. Later, we'll look beyond the EU with author and researcher Elizabeth Brough, whose new fascinating book argues that globalization as we know it is actually collapsing.
Another data point, of course, was the Ukraine war, which is when Putin, in effect, said, well, I don't care about your sanctions, which will mean that Russia gets shut out of the globalized economy. My top priority is getting Ukraine.
EU leaders wanted to make the economy their top priority when they gathered for a summit this week. But reality once again set in and foiled their plans. Foreign policy came to the fore, with leaders scratching their heads over how to respond to Iran's attack on Israel and calling on each other to urgently deploy air defense capabilities to Ukraine rather than keep them at home. My colleague Barbara Moons joined me to help us unpack the ballooning European Council summit agenda. So Barbara, as this podcast airs, the EU leaders will have just wrapped up their latest European Council summit. And what I find interesting about this one was the agenda was kind of in flux a lot due to world events. Can you walk us through how it changed a bit?
Yeah, of course. So on Thursday, the idea was always to focus on the EU's competitiveness. But then on Wednesday evening, the idea was to have a leaders' discussion during dinner, which would focus on Turkey. Germany had a long-standing request to send a positive sign towards Turkey on the EU's relationship with Ankara. At the same time, this is a sensitive issue, for example, for countries like Cyprus. But then, of course, you had certain events.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seemed like the EU kind of wanted to get back to the business from the before time. So these longstanding issues of Turkey and the economy, but then events got in the way.
Exactly. We had the Iran attack against Israel. So that overshadowed the entire political week here in Brussels. On Tuesday, we had a foreign affairs ministers meeting. And so the message, the consistent messaging throughout the week from European leaders has been to really urge Israel to restrain itself and not to have any escalation towards a regional conflict. And then apart from the Middle East, you had other countries saying then, well, if we talk about Turkey, we should also talk about Lebanon. If we talk about the Middle East, we should also talk about Ukraine, because since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, there has become this habit almost of having very strong language in the European Council on supporting Ukraine, with the risk that this time around, you know, there hasn't been much new to announce when it comes to the EU support to Ukraine, and also that Iran is and the Middle East have been overshadowing the Ukraine conflict throughout the week.
Yeah, I mean, you made a really interesting observation in sort of an internal meeting that we had, that at least prior to the Iran attacks, it looked like we might have a UCO summit for like the first time in 2 years where Ukraine wasn't on the agenda. But sort of ironically...
Exactly. And that was something that immediately Ukraine's allies in the bloc was something that they fought against, right, during the preparatory meetings of the European Council. And so that has led to new council conclusions, which actually have, again, like this almost standard language when it comes to Ukraine, because you do see that we're at this point in the conflict, you know, where Ukraine is really struggling, where we also had a lot of voices coming from Ukraine, but also the Baltics and other countries saying, well, you know, if France and the UK have actually helped Israel in kind of fending off this air attack, why can they not do the same thing for Ukraine when you have this war on the European continent?
This whole time, though, back to kind of where we first started, the funny thing was you could feel this yearning by leaders to be able to actually kind of look inward, especially ahead of these elections, to focus on the EU's own internal economy. And we're hearing all of this talk about competitiveness. Mm-hmm. A few weeks ago, we had an episode about a backlash against the Green Deal, but now these council conclusions have this new European competitiveness mm-hmm. deal. Can you walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, of course. And maybe to start with the first point, linking it to foreign policy, I don't think per se there is a contradiction. On the contrary, because of the changing geopolitics, with China becoming even more assertive on the global stage, with the threat of Russia, with a potential Trump presidency, the EU on security level sees, okay, we really have to step up in order to defend itself. But you can draw the parallel towards the economic side of things, right? The age of globalization is declining. We really have to make sure that we don't lose our competitive edge towards other global partners and rivals. And in order to do that, there have been all these reports that have been tasked and that are now coming. So we have the one this week from Letta, the former Italian prime minister. We have one coming from Mario Draghi, another former Italian prime minister, that really have to lay the groundwork of what are we going to do in the next European Commission to make sure that Europe is still competitive. And at the same time, also that we make sure that what we want to do in terms of climate policy and green transition, that we can do that without losing our economic support and with actually having the money in order to achieve all those goals.
So indeed, Barbara, you brought up Enrico Letta, the former Italian prime minister and now the president of the Jacques Delors Institute. And coincidentally, our colleague Giovanna Faggionato interviewed him about this report on overhauling the single market. And we're going to hear a few clips from that conversation in a second. You know, his bottom line is that it's outdated and it makes it super hard for the EU to be competitive. His point that I hadn't really thought that much about before is that the single market is incomplete. There are these black holes, essentially, that haven't been part of it. So things like energy and telecommunications. And he also said we need a true saving and investment union.
The lack of a single market framework on the financial markets is today one of the biggest problems for the European Union. There's this figure that the European Central Bank put on the table of 300 billion euros that are the dimension of European savings that are each year crossing the Atlantic and joining the American financial market. And these savings are there and they are strengthening the American enterprises. And these same enterprises are crossing back the Atlantic to buy European enterprises. And this is a paradox. So one of the core of the future single market has to be the way in which the financial market at European level becomes a single financial market able to attract investments.
So yeah, Letta told Giovanna that it's crucial because otherwise we might soon have a big problem finding enough money to finance policies like the Green Deal. For now, the money is coming from the EU's Next Generation Fund, which is this recovery instrument designed to help member states bounce back after the pandemic. But the money is going to run out in a few years.
Will there be less public money than needed for the Green Deal as a result of the shift in focus to other goals like defense or the enlargement?
After Next Generation EU end, the big risk is that we don't have enough money at all for the green transition. And there's no idea on the post Next Generation EU. I would like to enhance and to support the way in which the future green transition can be financed. There are so many studies, the Commission on the one hand, Draghi's figure on the 500 billion euros that are showing that the transition needs a big financial effort. And my guess is that this financial effort can arise from both private and public.
So, Barbara, I'm going to come back to you in a minute to ask about the private and public spending, or, you know, meaning the common debt idea or state aid rules. But before that, let's just hear one last sort of metaphorical clip from Giovanna's chat with Enrico Letta.
We need to create a single market with teeth, and it is absolutely necessary in a word like the word of today.
So, Barbara, back to you. This idea of a single market with teeth, what does that mean in practice? Do you understand what he's saying there?
I think there has been kind of this wider consensus that when we celebrated 30 years of the single market, that the single market is one of the EU's biggest assets, but that it also really has to be deepened and has to be stronger. So when it comes to a lot of issues, but for example, the Capital Markets Union, for example, when it comes to subsidies and how, you know, which countries can use subsidies, which cannot, etc., that we have to make sure that the EU's 27 countries are actually working together and not against each other. So there has been that consensus. Now that report, this week we had a first kind of tour de table among the European leaders on which then, you know, the next European Commission will build. And I think that that is also the point where you will have certain tensions coming up again, because obviously, you know, it's one thing to agree on this is the problem, we should do something about it. And then the next step is what are we actually going to do about it? And let this report, you know, it's definitely a kickstarter for the discussion, but it, in the end, it is a political decision by EU leaders and by the next European Commission and the next European Parliament.
And just looking through the crystal ball, can you help us understand what the two sides might be roughly as far as these tensions and the differing response and how to tackle this issue?
Yeah, I think that in the EU, we have this, you know, traditional divide between, you know, the frugal, more Nordic countries and then, you know, the south of Europe. And this divide, sometimes it plays up again. And we will see that, I think, in this discussion, definitely, but also in the discussion about the next European budget, on which negotiations will start after the election and which is really a core European budget. Those are the moments where key decisions will have to be made on how are we going to finance all this? What do we want to finance? Is agriculture still such a big thing? All those questions will come up. And then you traditionally have these kind of two camps, the North versus the South, flaring up again.
North kind of wanting to limit spending, whereas the South more open to seeing more EU spending, maybe more open to things like joint debt.
Exactly, and more investments to make sure that the economy keeps slowing. At the same time, you also have this tension in this debate on single market, on competitiveness. You also have a tension between the bigger member states, those who have the deep pockets to really hand out state subsidies, and then some of the more smaller states. And it's the smaller states that have really also put this issue of competitiveness on the agenda to make sure that they're not out-competed by their own European counterparts in Paris, Berlin, or Rome.
It's interesting. People have different ideas of who they're competing with. Are they competing with Beijing? Are they just competing with Paris and Berlin? Meanwhile, looking ahead to the next mandate, it wasn't on the council agenda, but leaders have nonetheless been discussing sort of in parallel this other document from Council President Charles Michel called the Strategic Agenda. And it sets out the priorities for the next parliament and commission, at least as Michelle would like to start the conversation. It leaked a few days ago and it was immediately causing controversy. Why was that?
Exactly, because it is actually, I mean, it's a pretty bland document in the sense that it just kind of outlines the subjects that Michelle is now currently discussing with leaders, such as competitiveness, which we just discussed, defense, security, other, you know, pretty straightforward themes. But if you put this one next to the one that was preparing the commission for 2019-2024, then you can see the difference. Our climate colleagues rightfully pointed out that in a document from 5 years ago, climate was very much in the focus, which is not the case anymore right now. And so there you can really see the kind of shift in tone that we've already also seen, for example, in the campaign of European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen for the elections, and in general in the tone of, for example, her center-right EPP party. They don't want to give up on the goals that were in the Green Deal or that is in the climate policy. They just don't want to talk about it anymore. They now want to talk about other issues such as competitiveness or defense. And you see that really reflected also in this draft strategic agenda, which obviously is still subject to change, and it will be presented towards the next European Commission president to really give kind of a signal from leaders, this is what we want for the next 5 years.
Yeah, and that's what I always find so interesting, the difference between sort of policy practicalities and the political rhetoric. So if I'm understanding you well, it sounds like, and also thinking of what Letta was saying, politically we see tension and almost sort of a black and white between a Green Deal and a competitiveness deal. But in terms of the policies that they're actually implementing, it's still arguably maybe on the same track. They just talk about it differently.
Exactly. And also, we had a speech, for example, from Belgian Prime Minister Alexander De Croo this week, kind of on the midterm of his Belgian presidency of the Council of the EU. And he said on the record very clearly, he doesn't see a contradiction between a Green Deal and a competitiveness deal. On the contrary, if we want to achieve the goals of the Green Deal, we have to make sure that we remain competitive so that we can actually afford the Green Deal and that we tag along on the green transition together with China and with the US. And you see that, you know, in specific policy fields or policy files as well. For example, when it comes to electric cars, where there's really this race going on with the US and China. So it doesn't have to be a contradiction, but obviously, you know, some are definitely making contradiction of it, especially towards the right of the political center.
Well, yeah, so we'll be watching for the next term to see if we can have our green cake and eat it too. But for now, Barbara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's how we roll here at EU Confidential, folks. Come for the high-end discussion about European politics and policy. Stay for the loopy mixed metaphors. So do stay, because we have another high-end discussion coming up after the break. I'm talking to Elizabeth Brough, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. She's a frequent contributor to Politico and the author of a new book, Goodbye Globalization, The Return of a Divided World. Stay with us.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm joined here in the studio by Elizabeth Brough, and we were just saying it's exciting because we have spoken many times over Zoom, over the phone, but this was our first time actually meeting in person. Elizabeth, you're here to promote a book. Tell us all about it.
It is exciting to be here and meet you in person, Sarah. And it's also exciting to talk about the book, not because it's my book, but because we are living through this incredibly tumultuous time in global relations. And the book is about the rise and now beginning decline of globalization. It's called Goodbye Globalization. And it doesn't mean that globalization is completely over. It just means we are beginning to wave goodbye. And the reason that I started writing it is that I started hearing from people in the business world a few years ago that something was changing fundamentally. And so I thought, this is something that I should write about. And I did. And as I was writing the book, this process that they had been noticing accelerated. And now it's basically on everybody's mind all the time.
What are some of the key data points or examples that you would point to illustrate how we're seeing this departure of globalization?
The first one that I think is really obvious is China's crackdown on the private sector. It's something that I think most of us thought would never happen, because if you have engineered your country's rise from a country where people ride bicycles and don't have a great range of consumer products to an extremely impressive level of prosperity, why would you ever take any other path? But we saw a couple of years ago that the Chinese government started cracking down on the private sector, not just Western companies, which they started punishing as proxies for the home governments. And that was one really important point. If you wanted to maintain increased prosperity, maintain trade with Western countries at all costs, you would not punish Western companies as proxies for the home governments. But that's what the Chinese government did. And they also cracked down on the foremost success stories of the Chinese economy, people like Jack Ma. If your top priority is increasing the country's prosperity, you don't crack the country's golden eggs, whatever the appropriate metaphor may be. But that's what they did. And that was such a pivotal moment, because that's when Xi Jinping and the rest of the Chinese government demonstrated that their top priority is not increased prosperity, it is remaining in power. So that was one data point.
And Jack Ma is the CEO of Alibaba, this big e-commerce site.
Yes, and not just e-commerce site, massive tech conglomerate. I mean, he is Mr. Chinese private sector. So he was clearly becoming too powerful, and that's why they cracked down on him. Then another data point, of course, was the Ukraine war, which is when Putin, in effect, said, well, I don't care about your sanctions, which will mean that Russia gets shut out of the globalized economy. My top priority is getting Ukraine. And you can say, well, that's a totally illogical top priority. Well, it is his top priority. And so that's how Russia bid farewell. But then we also noticed at the same time here at home that the people who had been unhappy about globalization for many years, starting with the people who lost their jobs when their companies downsized or shut altogether to move to Central Europe and also to countries like China, and indeed later also from Central Europe to other countries, all of those people were unhappy, and not just people who had lost their jobs, but people who lived in those communities. They were always talked over. They were seen as somehow, you know, lost in the past, and, you know, these were the new times and you just have to get with the program. But they never forgot that sense of aggravation. And around 2015, 2016, we started seeing them and others voicing their concerns about globalization and, by extension, this global elite that, by the way, includes the European Union, capitals everywhere. It all sort of blended, melted together into this protest against the elite. And of course, Donald Trump exploited it masterfully. The Brexit vote was a result of it. But it didn't have to go that way. People could have listened to these concerns earlier, but this is the way it went.
Yeah. And so your book kind of lays out two major bits of conventional wisdom that drove globalization that then sort of turned out not to be true. So one was this idea that if goods and trade are crossing borders, then soldiers will not. We saw that's not true with the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And also that, yeah, these kind of losers of globalization, the people who lose their job, they can be placated with cheap goods and service jobs. And as you showed, that hasn't worked out. But one thing that does confuse me just in this precise moment is we are now seeing a dialing back, European leaders have just been meeting to talk about how to boost European industry and be less dependent on cheap Chinese goods. But people are really angry right now about inflation and the cost of living. They're mad about globalization, but aren't they also just going to be really mad when we dial back globalization?
They will be. And I think it's important to remember that globalization is, it's not a theory. I spoke with an academic the other day who said, well, you don't mention the theories behind this in your book. I don't think it's about theories. It's about people. It's about leaders, business leaders, political leaders, and so-called ordinary people. And it was never an ideology or a political theory. It just happened because it seemed to be so advantageous for everybody except those who lost their jobs. Now, when it comes to trying to do it differently or sort of reversing a little bit for a while, what will that look like? Many like the idea that we should make more goods at home so that we are not overly dependent on countries that may decide to try to harm us, either using our dependence on them or just to harm us militarily. But what does it look like? Well, it looks like more expensive goods, because the reason globalization was so attractive was that even if you make goods far away, the combined cost of making them far away, transporting them to around the world to where they need to go, and then getting them to me is cheaper than making them closer to me. So it will be more expensive if we make goods at home. And somebody, our political leaders, will have to have an honest debate, conversation with the public about the fact that we have had artificially cheap consumer goods for over three decades now. It was artificially cheap because it was built on this idea that countries will just get along and so we won't have to worry about anything. We can just trade with whoever we like because commerce is all that matters. It's not all that matters. And now if we're going to make consumer goods at home, or indeed any kind of goods, they will be more expensive. Who's going to tell people?
You. I think you're doing it. I guess you're not running for office.
It would be an unsuccessful run. I think those who are a couple of years away from being termed out, that's their task now.
Okay. Yikes. Since we're looking for you to deliver the bad news to us, what is the new model that you kind of see emerging?
So it's not autarky and it's not massive protectionism either. It is more trade among countries that are at least can get along and have some sort of basic understanding of wanting to get along. So it's clearly the West, but what are we going to replace China with? What are we going to replace Russia with? China will still be there, but less intensively than in the past. So we have to replace that with something. And so it's incumbent on Western leaders and business leaders now to find those countries that we can do more business with that are not exactly like us, because the West is a small part of the world. They're not exactly like us, but friendly enough, or at least not hostile. And that can be countries like India, Vietnam, the Philippines, the Middle East, Mexico, Turkey, countries like that. And you can say, well, Erdogan is so annoying and sometimes he's friends with Putin. Well, he can be annoying, but Turkey is not an adversary. So that I think that helps them qualify for this loose alliance that we have to build up. And we should remember that China is aided by its now sidekick, former mentor, Russia, is building this sort of a loose alliance itself.
Turkey's not the only problematic country in that list. I mean, India also is seeing a lot of democratic backslide issues. The Philippines, pretty much all the countries on that list. I mean, are we just kind of bounce from one country to another and wait until they become so bad, like China, that we can't work with them anymore and try to move on to somebody else?
No, I think we have to do trade differently. The way we did it, starting in the 80s with China and then in the 90s, China and various Latin American countries and then the former Warsaw Pact in the 90s, was that we assumed that they would want to become like us. And that was sort of an inevitable process. And it was almost like a romance, you know, oh, we'll trade with you and you'll build up market economies and eventually you will become like us, because that's the eventual goal of every country, we thought. But it's not. And that's what Russia and China have demonstrated. And so I think what we need to do with these other countries is trade on a more less romantic basis, more pragmatic basis, where we say, well, it's all about trade. It's not about becoming closer as countries or as cultures. It's just about trade. So rather than an embrace, I think we should go for the handshake.
All right. That's interesting. It's almost like we need to become more transactional because this sort of values-based effort has failed.
It has. Yes, and it was a unique moment in history in the early 90s when the West could export not just its way of doing business, and we should remember that it was really exporting a way of doing business. It wasn't just an export of businesses. It was teaching other countries how to run a market economy. If you were a banker in the 90s, 80s, you went to China and taught Chinese officials and private sector types how to run a banking system. What a unique moment in history. But now that moment has gone where we can export market economy coupled with some sort of general liberal values. Very few countries are willing to accept that sort of intervention. They may be happy to learn a little bit about how to run a banking system, but they don't want any teaching about democratic values. So that unique moment is gone, and it's uncomfortable, I think, for the West to realize that, oh, countries will stand up for themselves and they'll say, oh, don't come with your preaching lessons about how to run our domestic affairs. We will trade with you and we can learn a little bit about various market aspects, but that's it. We can say it's painful, but it is a reality.
That's another really interesting point you have in the book. You have a chapter about Gen Z, how they, on the one hand, want to feel good about the stuff that they're buying. They, you know, were boycotting, or at least looking into the possibility of boycotting companies that were still operating in Russia, trying to avoid cotton that was made by forced labor in Xinjiang. But many of them that you talked to realized that it was not actually easy or maybe useful to boycott companies. So what's kind of the solution for this generation that wants to feel good about what they're doing?
I think this is a really unpredictable moment, both for Gen Z or Gen Z and for companies. So Gen Z has much higher expectations on companies than people, I think, maybe aged 35 and over, who essentially expect a good price point versus quality, and that's it. But we don't expect companies to take any particular positions on political, let alone geopolitical issues of the day. Gen Z expects that. But on the other hand, how do you punish a company that you think is not doing the right thing? Again, as a result of globalization, companies have extremely complex supply chains, and you don't really know where their things are made. And they can say, we don't manufacture in Xinjiang and we are not in Russia. But can you actually investigate the veracity of such claims? And so that's where this all becomes very unpredictable, because Gen Z or various activist members of Gen Z will then descend on a brand that they've discovered still doing business in Russia or operating in Xinjiang, and they'll engage in a hashtag campaign against that company, whereas another company may be much worse when it comes to doing business in places that violate human rights. So it's so random. And also think about what this does for companies. You have to do business somewhere outside the West. Not everybody is as perfect as us, right? So where is that going to be if you will be called out by Gen Z wherever you do business that's outside the West? What does it mean for your operations and who you sell to and so forth? So it's really an extremely random and unpredictable situation for companies.
One of the things that I love about all of your work and the reasons that we're often in touch is because you do this great job of not just talking about the academic theory and sort of elite opinion, but you really find like real people to talk to and you use them to give examples. So you talk to a woman who lives on a Swedish island. She had been kind of against Nord Stream, and now she's kind of turning out to be vindicated. You talk to some business titans who are now saying maybe we weren't taking the right approach. Can you show us your process a little bit? How do you find people?
Yes, I want to have as broad a perspective as possible. So I didn't want this book to have a UK bias or an American bias. I wanted to be as fair as possible to all sides. So I tried to include people from as many parts of the world as I could, and also from all walks of life, so business, politics, and ordinary people, and people taking different positions. And so I go through what I want, and then I look at who do I know. It's almost like a casting card where I have the various positions I want to fill, and then I go out and ask people to recommend people for those positions. And I think if we have learned anything from globalization, it is that the so-called ordinary people matter. And if they don't get say early on in whatever the issue may be, they're not going to be silenced. They will voice that opinion in some shape at some point. Next time we do this, we try something like this, it should be of a more consultative nature so that people feel that they were included in this process that really affects every single one of us.
A lot of establishment politicians are hoping for goodwill from voters in Europe in June, in the US in November. Kind of an unkind question, but do you have any predictions for both the European European Parliament elections and the US election.
I think we'll have another round of voter belief that populism is an answer. Then, of course, every time you try populism, it turns out not to have any answers, but apparently has to be tested first. And people have to realize that, oh, it's not as easy as some populists think it is. But I think it's also a moment for so-called establishment politicians or from more traditional parties to be more transparent with people and have an honest conversation. And it is okay for politicians to admit that issues are not easy to solve or to know how to even begin to tackle. And if we can have more of that kind of conversation, I think people will feel involved. They will be less drawn to populist ideas that will end up not working anyway.
Yeah. So EU leaders have just been discussing this new EU competitiveness deal. It's sort of being cast as this response to the Green Deal, but more focused on industry and the economy. Do you see this as really a serious response to some of the issues that we've been talking about, or is it just kind of an election period message that won't really have much of an effect?
Well, it's a sincere effort, and I think it has less to do with the election than with the fact that the US passed this incredible Inflation Reduction Act that was a win-win-win for America. It helps bring jobs back to America. It reduces, as a result, dependence on China. It accelerates the green transformation. So what's not to like? Well, what's not to like is that companies are so attracted to this IRA, including European companies, that European companies invest in America rather than investing here. And it seems to me that American legislators forgot the fact that it would have an effect on America's best friends. And so here we have the IRA. It was modified slightly after having been passed. But still, European companies will be investing in America thanks to the IRA. And so we need something similar here to incentivize them to do similar things here, because we can benefit, so to speak, from the crumbling globalization by bringing more jobs here, not necessarily UK jobs that were originally British jobs going back to the UK or German jobs going back to Germany. But within the EU, German firms could friendshore to Slovakia, to another part of the EU. And we don't have anything as powerful as IRA. So these are partial measures. They're not going to be as punchy as IRA, but I think the more the better. And let's hope some of these jobs come back. And by the way, it's worth remembering, it's not the jobs that left the countries that are coming back. It will be more qualified, more sophisticated manufacturing jobs. And that is a question, I think, Sarah, for one of your future podcasts. Who is going to perform these jobs? And that is the second stage of what we are experiencing now. If all these jobs return, who are the future factory workers? Where are we going to get them from? That's for your next podcast.
Okay, duly noted. Well, you have had the answers to all of my questions, so thank you so much.
I don't have a career in politics.
That's okay. We're happy to have you keep doing your research and coming on the podcast. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find Elizabeth's new book, Goodbye Globalization, The Return of a Divided World, wherever you buy books. So that's almost all we have for you this week. We've been talking about the corporate buzzword of competitiveness, but another buzzword also emerged from the bubble this week: Bolshewokeism. So Bolshewokeism was made up by one of the right-wing speakers at the National Conservative Conference. And that was supposed to take place in Brussels this week. We were definitely going to cover it. Nigel Farage, the Brexiteer, was going to be there. He's always good for a headline-grabbing quote. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban was also going to be there, along with other luminaries from the far right. But some of the local mayors here in Brussels, who are also facing their own election coming up in October, they decided to make a whole issue out of it. And so this NatCon conference was supposed to take place at one venue in one part of Brussels, and the mayor was like, nope, it's going to cause public disorder. Gotta shut it down. So they found a new venue in a different commune of Brussels, and that mayor was like, nope, gotta shut it down. Third venue, they actually held the conference and the police showed up and tried to shut it down.
Okay, I'm done playing. Thank you.
At the moment, the police are saying that the event is creating public disturbance and therefore it will be closed down gradually.
Well, it ended up turning the conference into much bigger news than it would have been. And now this conference, which is co-hosted by MCC Brussels. It's Viktor Orban's think tank here in Brussels. They are now proclaiming themselves champions of free speech. Many mainstream activists said that this was essentially an own goal by the forces trying to fight the far right. It gave the far right ammunition to show that this Bolshevikism is a real thing and that cancel culture is a real thing in Brussels.
What's happened here is now on the stage of whether it's global media, we can see that legally held opinions from people who are going to win national elections is no longer acceptable here in Brussels, the home of globalism, because if you don't agree with ever closer union, you must be a bad dude.
So that's really it now for this week at EU Confidential. Please remember to rate us and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also write to us at podcast@politico.eu. Thank you to Christina Gonzalez, Politico's deputy head of audio, and to Diana Sturris, our senior audio producer. I'm Sarah Wheaton. See you next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.